this is a special podcast of the 2013 British Humanist Association Darwin Day Lecture, this year given by Sir Tom Blundell and chaired by Richard Dawkins. This podcast is brought to you by The Pod Delusion. The Pod Delusion is a weekly news magazine podcast about interesting things, from politics to science to culture, all from a sceptical rationalist point of view. You can find out more about The Pod Delusion at poddelusion.co.uk. But now, here's Richard Dawkins introducing Sir Tom.
Well, first, before coming on to the business of the evening, I wanted to make a little announcement, which I think is quite good news. Since we lost from Parliament, Evan Harris, who is a great luminary of this society and a great pillar of rationalism in Parliament, we have had a sad lack of people of our persuasion in Parliament. And so it's a minor pleasure that we've had an addition to the House of Lords. Matt Ridley, who actually is a hereditary peer, he is now Viscount Ridley, but that, of course, means nothing. But there's a curious little loophole whereby hereditary peers are allowed to be elected by their peers. A small minority of them are allowed to be elected by their peers to actually sit in the House of Lords. And Matt Ridley was among a group of hereditary peers who were up for election a couple of days ago. And he won against Lord Hailsham, Viscount Hogg, and lots of other peers. So we now have Matt Ridley in the House of Lords, and I think that's something. It's been said that all of philosophy is a series of footnotes on Plato. I sincerely hope that's not the case, because if so, it doesn't say much for philosophy. I had a colleague at New College, Oxford, a very distinguished ancient historian, who made it his life's work to try to answer the knotty question, who is the greatest shit of all time, St. Paul or Plato? But I think it really could be said that all of modern biology is a series of footnotes on Darwin, and that's a genuine compliment to biology. I think many of us are fond of fantasizing about what it would be like to revive Charles Darwin and watch his dawning excitement as we bring him up to date on his own subject. And today, on Darwin's 204th birthday, my fantasy dream would be to introduce Charles Darwin to Sir Tom Blundell and listen in on the conversation. I think that of all things in modern biology that might light up Darwin's intelligent old eyes, perhaps the most enthralling would be the remarkable facts of molecular biology. Darwin was, of course, thoroughly familiar with the detailed comparability of animal structures at the level of gross anatomy, how they're modified for different functions, and how you can compare them bone for bone, detail for detail, mapping for mapping, with different vertebrate skeletons with each other. This was and is knockdown evidence for common descent. But Darwin would have been riveted to learn that you can do exactly the same thing with protein molecules. The same principle of one-for-one mapping applies not just between proteins across animals, but also within proteins, the different amino acids, and of course the DNA triplets that code for them. Darwin could trace the closeness of cousinship between any vertebrate and any other by comparing their skeletons in a one-for-one, bone-for-bone correspondence. He would have been astounded by the idea that you can do exactly the same thing with letter-for-letter, word-for-word, sentence-for-sentence correspondence in the voluminous literary texts that are in every cell of every living body. And moreover, the same kind of structure, function, correspondence, that correspondence between structure and function works at the level of protein molecules as well. The functioning of proteins is determined by the exact 3D, three-dimensional shapes into which the polypeptide chains spring, which is determined by their one-dimensional sequence of amino acids, and that in turn, of course, is determined by the sequence of DNA nucleotides. Darwin would have loved to be shown how it's possible to study the process of evolution at the molecular level. He'd have been astonished at the speed with which evolution races along at the molecular level. He'd have been intellectually delighted, although disturbed by the medical implications, of the way natural selection finds ways to evade our best medical efforts to cure disease, how natural selection actually works within cancerous tumours, for example, and produces very, very fast evolution, as Sir Tom may well tell us. Darwin would surely almost burst with joy and pride in the achievements of his intellectual great-grandchildren. And of those intellectual great-grandchildren, he would surely warm to Sir Tom Blundell. Like Darwin, Tom Blundell is a man of superlative scientific ability, coupled with becoming modesty. Like Darwin, he's a man of strong and humane political convictions, although obviously tailored differently for their own times. He's a true original. Even Darwin didn't pay for his wife in cows. Nor was Darwin a jazz trumpeter. Tom Blundell was an active left-wing politician, successfully active, in my own city of Oxford. He's interested in art as well as science, in the relationship between them. I loved a phrase which he used in Desert Island Discs, of all places, where he spoke of the symmetry and the beauty and the melody of science. He did his doctorate in Oxford. He worked with that extraordinary woman, Dorothy Hodgkin, whom I knew only from a distance as a sort of legendary, almost mythical figure. He was inspired by J.D. Burnell, whose chair he succeeded in Birkbeck College, Burnell known as Sage, one of the fathers of crystallography. That was after a short spell at Sussex University. He finally became the Sir William Dunn Professor of Biochemistry at Cambridge, from which he's recently retired. He's always pursued a parallel, very active life in public affairs, especially as they affect science. Among many other things, he was Director General of the Agriculture and Food Research Council, the founding chief executive of the BBSRC, the Biotechnology Biological Sciences Research Council, and he recently came back as their non-executive chairman. He's been president of the Science Council since 2011, promoting the role of science in society. An immensely busy man, obviously. He even has his own company for developing drugs to fight cancer and other things. I'm hugely looking forward to this Darwin Day lecture, and I hope you'll forgive my fancy if I imagine the ghost of Charles Darwin hovering over us and enjoying what I'm sure will be a fascinating Darwin Day lecture on the emergence of drug resistance, molecular evolution, and new medicines for cancer and tuberculosis. Ladies and gentlemen, Sir Tom Blundell.
Well, Chairman Richard, thank you very, very much for that wonderful introduction. And thank you for the invitation to come and give this very prestigious lecture. I must say congratulations to the choir, to begin with. I felt that I'd rather sit down and listen to them than come and give you a talk. And congratulations to Richard for giving a very wonderful summary of the sort of things that I do. So today I'm going to talk about a very fast kind of evolution that we can study with modern technologies. But I just wanted to begin by saying that on the Today programme this morning, I was introduced as not somebody who is a fervent anti-creationist. Well, I just want to put it right. I am an anti-creationist. And I've had a relationship, I guess, with Darwin since I was, 14 or 15 and started reading about him, and with humanism since I was 15 in my little country grammar school, where the teacher set out to tell me about religion using science as an example. It set me against it from that moment. So I'm very pleased to come here to the Humanist Society and also to be associated with it for several years. So what I'm going to talk about is indeed, as Richard said, it's molecular evolution. It runs very much in parallel, underlies the evolution that most of us think about. But what I'm going to do today is to focus on two areas. One of them is cancer. And again, as Richard said, tumours are really very fast evolving sort of subparts of you, which seek selective advantage once they've been released from the restraints of whatever the tissue was originally. And the point that I really want to make in this lecture is that working on TB, and I started working on cancer, and I'll tell you later how I got involved in TB. It was because of Bill Gates came to my company and said, can't you use the technologies on cancer on TB? But as I've looked at TB, I've realized there's a huge similarity in that the Mycobacterium tuberculosis, like a tumor in your body, if you're unfortunate enough to have it, takes on huge numbers of mutations, just as occurs, of course, in the evolution of all organisms. But Mycobacterium tuberculosis takes them on extremely quickly to evade the human response or the animal response of its host. And we can follow that now because we can sequence the genomes and see what's happening in fantastic detail. And that's where I want to go in the lecture. I'm going to talk about these hugely complex events which start off with a very complex architecture of these very, very small objects, proteins, so you can get really tens of millions of, across your thumb, so they're very small. And within them, there's just a huge rate of mutation. And what we can do is put together the information from what's called second-generation sequencing with knowledge of the architecture of these to understand the emergence of resistance. And resistance occurs both in tumours and in MTB in a very similar way. And that's the point I want to make. But really my main message, and I'll come back to it at the end of my talk, is that you can really see evolution in front of your eyes occurring at a fast rate. But what is even more remarkable is that by understanding evolution, you can do something useful, and that is understand why we get resistance to drugs, and we can even think about making new drugs in the big fight against both tumours and pathogens. So I'm going to take you on a very complicated journey, and I apologise to those of you who are not scientists. I'll try to make some generally relevant points, but I'll have to go a little bit into the science from time to time. So let me begin by just saying a few words about what is cancer, because just to share a common ground, but I'm sure you know most of this. Cancer is a broad group of diseases, all involving unregulated cell growth. And one of them, well, you see here lung cancer on the top on the right, and then a very different kind of cancer, CML, the chronic myeloid leukemia. And they have many things in common. They all are due to abnormalities in DNA, due to the very fast rate of evolution. The cells grow and divide uncontrollably, forming malignant tumours, and they invade, of course, nearby parts of the body, and also, of course, more distant parts of the body through the lymphatic system and the bloodstream, and that's, of course, metastasis. And, of course, as you know, one in three people in the Western world develop cancer, and one in five die of it. So what's happening in cancer evolution? So we can now look at this, and we can understand how genome within the cells in your body, when exposed to mutagens, replicates incorrectly. We can follow that. We can follow the progressive divergence of the DNA sequence in each cell. And I should say, each cell in the tumour is different. And that's one of the things we're beginning to find out and is going to make it incredibly complex. And then, of course, somatic mutations, they're the mutations that occur in your body, eventually hit a critical gene, often an oncogene, and that provides a growth advantage. So that's the selective advantage that the tumour cell suddenly gains and allows it to compete in the environment of your body. And, of course, this results in the emergence of expanded clone derived from that cell. And then the additional mutations lead to metastasis. I thought I'd show you just one picture of something that I work on, although I'm not going to talk about it in general today. And that is one of the oncogenes that really lead to metastasis. It's called the c-MET oncogene, because it was first identified as an oncogene leading to metastasis. And what it does is it mediates the effects of a factor called hepatocyte growth scatter factor. The scatter factor is important because it means that the cells scatter from where they are in the tissue, and they often invade the collagen matrix. And this is a rather wonderful picture, I think. These are cells moving around as a result of having the hepatocyte growth factor. And you can see they move at quite a rate. And I should say that this is a picture from my friend and colleague, Emanu Gradi, who's been in Cambridge for 20 years, but has just gone back to run a group in Italy. He discovered with Michael Stoker, the scatter factor. And it's just one example of an oncogene. You can see that in a tumour, if you activated that oncogene, then the tumour cells would start moving. And that's what happens in metastasis. So we need to understand all of that. And we also need to understand a little bit about what's happened over the past few years. So in many of these oncogenes, and I've got an example here, it's a little bit complicated, but there are several what we call protein kinases, which turn out to be oncogenes. They tend to regulate pathways and growth. And one of the most significant events in the battle against cancer was just more than 10 years ago, when the molecule called Gleevec, it's sometimes called imatinib, it comes from a company, Novartis, was approved by the FDA, and that had a huge impact on the treatment and quality of life. It was a revolutionary targeted therapy, and patients with this CML, this leukemia, have gained a much better prognosis as a result. But what's happened, of course, is that over the years, many of the patients have begun to relapse. And so we see now, and I'm going to try and explain some of this to you, but on the right-hand side, you can see in molecular detail the effect of mutations which hit or accumulated in this oncogene. And what they do is they block the binding of the drug. So this is the cancer fighting back, and it does it in a number of ways. I'll say a little bit more about this later. But one of the most obvious ways is that it just blocks the site where the drug is coming in. But it blocks it in a way that it blocks the drug, but not the natural ligand, which in this case, for those of you who are scientists, is ADP or ATP. So that's the story. Now, TB, as I said, I got introduced to and so been learning rather desperately about it. It's, of course, never diagnosed in many cases. We've got the BCG vaccine, marginally protects people. And we've had a drug therapy which is depended on these what are called first-line drugs on the right-hand side. And one of the problems with TB therapy is it takes 6 to 9 months if you're a normal person. But as soon as you get drug resistance, then the time of treatment goes up tremendously. And this is being complicated, and I'll talk a little bit about this later on, by the fact that the compliance in many of the countries where TB is rife is incredibly difficult to maintain. And so you get people breaking from their drug regime and you get resistance growing. And the other feature, which is quite amazing, is after a big expansion in drug discovery around 30, 40 years ago, we've had only just one drug, and last week eventually approved. There's been 30 years without any new drugs, and that's partly a reflection of the fact that people thought it was a solved problem and it wasn't a Western problem on the whole. But it's also because it's a very difficult target, as I found out in my lab, and I'll say a bit more. And this has become acute because we've got multiple drug resistance occurring now. Now, of course, until very recently, it's not affected us in the UK very much. My grandfather died of consumption TB, and I was told that nobody else in the family ever would. Of course, what's happened is that it's grown in southern Africa. It has a huge death rate. That's been exacerbated by the lack of compliance. It's been exacerbated by HIV. And I just want to make the point, Richard referred to the fact that I bought my wife with cows. Well, I'm married to a brilliant lady from Matabeleland. She's in the centre there. She's actually a distinguished scientist with nearly 100 papers and 7 in Nature and working in Cambridge. But she came on her own to this country. I'm afraid I didn't wander through Africa to find her. But when I had to go through some formal marriage ceremony, I was told that I had to go to the great aunt and bargain with her about the number of cows. And everybody's asked me how many cows, and I'm never going to tell anyone. But I want to show you this picture here, because on the either side of my wife are my two daughters. They've been very lucky to have a good state education, I should say. One's a medical doctor, just qualified in Oxford, and the other's rather successful commercial lawyer. But we, of course, travel back to Africa a lot, and down here are my two of my great nephews. And what I wanted to say is that, of course, in that part of Africa, which is the south part of Zimbabwe near the border of Botswana, and South Africa, then you have a huge amount of HIV, about 40% of the adult population are HIV positive. We've had one person in our family die of AIDS, and what has been particularly difficult is we've had a number of people with TB. So though I didn't get into the problem from this route, I'm very, very much aware on a personal level of what the problems are. And so this question of drug resistance, the multi-drug resistance is defined as being resistant to two of the drugs, isoniazid and rifampicin. But as I said before, the problem is exacerbated because the patients often feel better after a while. The drug supplies come out, run out, or sometimes scarce. Then people forget to take their medication, and sometimes patients don't get effective therapy. And so this has led to huge problems. The second-line drugs, the prices are lower now, they're off patent, but they're pretty toxic. And so it's even more problematic, and you have to keep people on an even longer regime. So this is an important problem for many parts of the world, but it's becoming quite a problem in the UK as well. Now, both of those cases are cases of evolution, and of course evolution occurs through changes in DNA, but I have to remind you that selection is not on DNA, it's not on proteins, it's at the level of the organism. But in order to understand it, we have to understand how it's mediated, if you like, by proteins. So we have DNA to protein, and what happens, and this is actually HIV proteinase, I'll tell you a little bit about that in a moment, but of course we have mutations occurring in the DNA, and very quickly you get lots of mutations. In fact, HIV is very sloppy in the way it converts DNA eventually into protein, and so you have a huge accumulation of mutations very quickly, which is selectively advantageous. And I guess similar things happen in tumours once the restraints of the normal tissue are released. So if we want to understand all of this, we've got to understand the architecture of these proteins. And in order to see them, we can't see them with light. We have to see them with X-rays, and that's how I got into it. And I'm going to show you a little bit about my history, because it's an introduction to molecular evolution in a way. So I worked in the 60s on a problem which Dorothy Hodgkin, Richard referred to her, Nobel laureate for penicillin and B12, had started in the 1930s. I drifted into the lab. As Richard said, I was mainly interested in my modern jazz group, which I ran all through my Oxford days and before that as well, and after that, and in politics, mainly in anti-apartheid and the organisations related to that. So I walked in somewhat innocently. People often ask me, why after 30 years of Dorothy Hodgkin working on a problem, did you think you can solve it? Well, that's not why I went in there. I knew a bit about Dorothy Hodgkin. I knew a lot about J.D. Bernal, and it seemed to be a great place to be. I was just lucky because I was around then when we had a look at this insulin molecule. And, of course, Dorothy was a bit older. Here's Dorothy and myself. I sometimes, just to show you how long this problem took, but also to show you how beautiful I was in those days, and how I fitted the image maybe of a left-wing jazz musician. The first thing I thought about all of this was I was very lucky, and the second thing I thought about it was very beautiful. My grandfather was an artist, and I was delighted to see that thanks to the six molecules in the insulin up there and the 12 apostles, they both had threefold symmetry and had some similarity. However, other things began to cross my mind. But these were all interrupted because my politics and the big immigration into Oxford of people from Bangladesh, what is now Bangladesh, and also from the West Indies, had led to a lot of discrimination in the motorworks. And I became active in the city in trying to sort that out. And the Labour Party in the 60s asked me whether I would stand in East Oxford, in St Clement's Wall, which is on the right-hand side down here. Eventually I did at the end of the Wilson government, and every other Labour candidate lost their seat. I had a huge number of immigrants on the door. I doubled the vote and found myself in charge of, I think, finance, planning, health in the city, and took over as, after a little while of convincing the Labour Party that we should follow this policy. It was Morris Motors, of course, and I had a no-car policy. I eventually got them to oppose the motorway, and we took over Oxford City. And this is Oxford. Richard wasn't, I think, going to be affected by the motorway, which I stopped. But the one thing that nobody's tried to change in what I've done in my life was stopping the motorway. Nobody else has tried to drive one across the meadow and into East Oxford. I pedestrianised the centre. I got stopped by the minister, who's called Speed, if I remember, when I went down, from shutting Magdalen Bridge. But I did manage to do one or two other radical things, including make North Oxford in a conservation area. So this beautiful houses got conserved. But the point that I want to make is that all of this in planning struck me as rather like the cell, and there are lots of similarities. So in the cell on the left, you have a complex organisation with pathways and proteins, and the proteins are there. And in the city, I'm afraid this is not Oxford City, you have a similar complexity of buildings, which are rather like the organelles and the proteins. You have very complex building architecture. And, of course, on the proteins, you have amino acids as a sequence, and in buildings you have bricks and other things, but there's quite a lot of similarity. And so I once wrote a paper on joist braces and trusses in protein structure. The referee said he'd never heard such an appalling non-scientific idea and didn't ever want to read a paper from me again. Actually, Nature published it, thank goodness, and so I've been celebrating this, which I think is quite a useful analogy. But proteins and palaces, and of course they're all connected by pathways, and this is very important to understand. So planning and architecture is central, and I just want to say very quickly a few things about that at the local level. But life got a bit complicated because I was trying to play my jazz, I was running the city, and I got several papers in Nature, and life became impossible. So I left, and I went across Siberia. On the train, I got stuck in Khabarovsk. I moved to Japan, where I actually learnt some Japanese. Used to be able to lecture in it. Went down to Taiwan, listened to some Chinese opera. Moved across to India, spent time learning Carnatic music. And I came back. And as I went on that, I thought about insulin and evolution. This was, the hexamers that we'd seen, this is the six-fold symmetry, are actually in the granules in your body, in the beta cells of the pancreas. We could make analogies of that, and I could begin to think about the organization and function. And so as I went, I mixed science with music. I just show these two pictures because on the right-hand side is Kathy Hall, and she put on a concert in London. I met her 40 years ago on this trip, and she's running the London Beijing Opera. That was in London. But a few weeks ago this month, my old friend, who's a Carnatic vina player, I got him to put on a concert where we had about 800 people in India around a scientific meeting. So I mixed all of this. But while I was listening to the music, I was thinking of the melody of the sequences. And what I began to do is I realized I was in a privileged position because I had the architecture of an insulin molecule, and that's on the right. I think you have to draw it simply if you're going to understand it. And I knew about all of the sequences. And Fred Sanger, of course, was in Cambridge at the time, had determined lots of sequences. And so we could begin to ask questions about evolution. And I asked them in a rather different way. I said, I know this protein structure, architecture, and I'm privileged to know a number of sequences that Fred Sanger has determined. Not many other people were in that privileged position. So I could then ask the question, what range of other sequences might fit into that structure? And I did it by analysing, and I better swap over this, but various parts of the structure are rather like the braces, the disulfides in the protein for the scientific. There was a core, which is the centre of the architecture, and then there were other things that I didn't really understand at first and began to make sense of. And so I began to think about protein evolution. And, of course, you have a restraint on the organism where you're selecting, down to the individual cells, down to the proteins, which then, of course, put restraints on the variation that occurs in the sequences. And so I could ask questions, and I thought about this as I travelled around this long trip. I realised that animals and many fishes had this hexameric structure. Some had just two molecules, like the more primitive hagfish. And then there were funny things, like the guinea pig, which never got round to having this beautiful organisation. And when I was getting back, I started thinking about this, and I moved to Sussex and found John Maynard Smith, and thought I'd better go and read what he said. The first thing I picked up I didn't agree with, and that was a book where he was describing what Moto Kimura, and I've got to know him very well later, a very brilliant scientist, but he started talking about insulin and neutral evolution, and I could see from my analysis of the architecture that it was actually selection that led to those changes. And so what I did is to analyse that, and then I published a paper in Nature debating, this was nearly 40 years ago, on whether it was Darwinian selection or selectively neutral mutations. Of course, it was both, but some of the things that Moto Kimura thought were very high rates of change, he thought necessarily were neutral. In other words, they weren't affecting function. But in some cases in evolution, very fast change occurs after selection. So, and then I went on to think about the family and publishing a lot of speculative papers, which were rather nicely okay. So that's the background. You've got proteins evolving and sequences changing of the amino acids due to changes in the DNA. And then you've got selection at the animal level, but coming down to the level of the protein. But another thing that struck me about Dorothy Hodgkin is, though her husband was a member of the Communist Party and Dorothy was prevented from going into North America during the McCarthy period for her politics, she always used to go into Novo, Welcome, Eli Lilly. She had lots of friends there. So I was taken into these companies. And later on I began to think, well, it was obviously very useful to Dorothy, and Dorothy, I think, contributed in the area of diabetes. I was later working on a rather dull set of enzymes called pepsin, but there's a relative called renin which controls your blood pressure. And I found some rather remarkable things. So this is pepsin or renin, and you may not believe it, but the two halves of that, if I draw a line down the centre, are actually topologically equivalent. Everything in the right-hand side is there in the left. So I wrote a paper with a lot of colleagues suggesting that that had evolved from a gene duplication. And it was a fairly convincing argument, I found. But the problem was I couldn't find anything around at the moment that looked like it. And I wonder whether it existed anywhere. So I used to go in the library on Saturday mornings and search through, desperately looking for my ancestral molecule still somewhere around. And then, to my surprise, we found it first in Rouse sarcoma virus and and then in HIV. And in HIV, other people noticed the analogy, but nobody else noticed the implication that the HIV protonase had to be two molecules together. And because I was working on renin in antihypertension, I immediately had the idea I could take my prototype antihypertensives and try them in the AIDS program. So I went to companies and I told them, take your drugs from your lowering blood pressure program and try them in your AIDS program. They were absolutely amazed. They were less amazed. Well, they were quite amazed when they found they worked, not very well. But of course, right in there was this pair of scissors. And it turned out that the pair of scissors was necessary if the HIV virus... you see, HIV comes in here on the left-hand side. It goes into the cell, it reproduces itself, and it produces a single polypeptide which has to be clipped up, like a long string has to be clipped up in pieces. And so the virus, HIV virus, before it gets clipped up, is immature and not virulent. So I realized that if I could block this step of proteolysis, as it's called, I would have no active viruses. And so immediately, because we knew the architecture of this, and I was told off for speculating by all my peers, so eventually I published in Nature again the experimental architecture for this molecule, and that then provided the blueprint where I could think about designing a drug. And unfortunately, at that time, Margaret Thatcher asked me to head up a research council. So I was taken out, and then I was interviewed and told that I had formed a small company. I was told that I was now a government employee and I had to close my company. I went to, that was, by the way, in DTI, I went to the Department of Education, and they said, I hear an active politician. And I said, yes. Well, they said, you can't do that either. So I realized at that stage that I couldn't be a Marxist entrepreneur. What I did find is that the ideas we had were taken up by many companies, and many other people in parallel were discovering the very similar things. That led to a drug which is one of the cocktail of drugs that keeps AIDS patients alive. And what happened, if you look at it, is the AIDS virus, the HIV, has responded by having mutations all over it in order to get away from the drug. So this is the problem, again, of escape from your drug. So this is a paradigm for drug discovery, but we'll come back to the resistance. Now, I'm running out of time, so I'm going to have to whip through. So what has been happening since the early 90s in making drugs is that we take targets, often from the genome, we express the various components, we do a large screen with libraries, this happens in all the large companies, and you get a hit. And what has happened, basically, is that over the last 20 years, this model has proved not very successful. The cost of a drug has gone up to $2 billion. If you look at the increase of expenditure on drug discovery, it's been exponential, but the number of new drugs has stayed the same. So one of the things I did when I came out of the Research Council was to think whether I could use my HIV experience to develop a new methodology. And that's what I did, really, in this area here of screening chemical libraries. Now, I can't tell you very much about this, and I'm running out of time much more than I thought I was, but we developed a method where we used very small fragments of drugs to screen and did this as an experiment. And eventually, you get one of these fragments which bind to the target, and then we use biophysical methods and chemical methods. Gosh, you know, they do eventually attach themselves. And we then use chemists, I'm not a chemist, by the way, to elaborate these molecules and to form a new drug molecule. And we tried that out in my lab, and then we got $500,000 funding. It worked very well. Haran Jyoti, who is one of my ex-students, came out of Glaxo and contributed hugely to this. I stayed as a non-executive. The two people expanded into 80 and then 100. This is just screening with these fragments. This is the next stage of the discovery process. So what you do is you use all this knowledge of architecture to work out how to expand these small molecules and to get a molecule which eventually has high enough affinity to work in a whole animal as a model. I'm going to whip through this, but what we've done is many targets in the company moving to very high affinity compounds and then trying them on mouse xenografts. This is a tumour on a mouse, and show that this method works. But the main message I want to get over is that by having a knowledge of the three-dimensional structure, and we can design molecules that will fit in the space in those molecules complementarily and block the activity. And just in case you think I'm just saying this works without evidence, I've got 8 drugs in clinical trials. The company's now capitalized at $311 million and on the NASDAQ. That came out of two people in my lab. So it's quite useful. Also, we now have second generation, even third generation sequencing. So we can take the amino or the DNA sequences and change them into amino acid sequences and have huge amounts of data. And I'm going to whip through this bit very quickly. We can organize the data in databases, we can have assembly lines, and we can predict what the genome looks like in terms of its architecture. I'm going to go right through this. And we can also predict the mutation. So what we can do is, from the knowledge we have of a small percentage of the genome, we can predict about half of the gene products fairly accurately, and another 25% reasonably well. So we have a picture of the architecture of all, 75% of the genome. So something like Mycobacterium tuberculosis, now that architectural problem, we have a model. And so I can now begin to think about the two problems of cancer and TB. Now, in cancer, of course, there are Mendelian-type mutations, and they are ones that are inherited. And many diseases, like this is Bertholdt-Dubé syndrome that I work on. I've got another group working on this in my basic lab. And this gives you these little benign tumours on your face. If you become homozygous in it, it becomes a very aggressive tumour and people die. So we've been trying to work out what the mutations are and how they affect this particular kind of tumour. Another area where I've worked is in the breast cancer related tumours, where we've known for a long time that BRCA 1 and 2 are related to early onset breast cancers. And what I've been able to do, along with my colleague Ashok Venkataraman in Cambridge, is to map the critical mutations that occur and try to understand what's happening in these Mendelian diseases. they're fairly easy to understand, of course very difficult to do anything about, but we can begin to understand how the mutations affect the stability of these protein architectures. I'm not going to go through this. And then we can take individual types of cancer. And this is a study I've done with Tim Eisen over the last 5 or 6 years, who's in oncology in Cambridge. And this is these very nasty renal cell carcinomas in what's known as the von Hippel-Lindau disease. And we can track these through. And just take away from this is that the various mutations, we can begin to understand what they're doing and how the cancer's originating. And what I can also do is to start thinking then about the more difficult problem, and that is the kinds of cancers that you get which are not so dependent on the inherited gene, but are often really complex. They're like other polygenic disorders where you have a number of genes. Each one can exist okay on its own, but you put them all together and they can cause cancer. So what we've been trying to do there is to watch the evolution of these tumours. So you can sequence the tumours using second generation, third generation sequencing methods. And then we can see the huge array of changes. And we've been trying to use our rational methods then to work out which are the drivers. Because if we can work out what the drivers are, then we can begin to advise on medicines. And here I've been very dependent on the Wellcome Trust programs, their Cancer Genome Project, where they've been identifying genes that are mutated and trying to understand their effects. So you can understand that if I can identify in a tumour the driver, the mutations that are causing the disease, I can advise the clinician as to which drug they should take. And that's the first ambition of all of this. And the COSMIC database is just one of these databases which tells you what's happening in tumours begins to allow you to think about it in a rational way. And what I've done here is just to plot these massive sets of mutations on to one group of proteins, the kinases. And I can begin to say, well, look, some of them, the purple ones, I think are going to cause possibly some change in the cell activity, whereas the other ones are not going to be important. And usually what we have to do then is to go into experiment to test these hypotheses. But what it means is we get closer and closer to understanding the mutations in tumours. And I hope eventually we'll then have a range of drugs that we can say these are appropriate for these particular kinds of tumours. So you can imagine, as in the Institute of Cancer Research in London, that you take out the tumours in the Marsden Hospital, you sequence the tumours, you move them into the fundamental science, and then you see what is happening and you advise the clinician which drugs to take, but you also say this is possibly a new target. But of course, in all of these areas, you've got relapses occurring, and this is a problem. And what we've been doing in my lab also, and this is one of my young, very, very intelligent students, Harry Jubb, is we've been trying to work out the effects of these mutations, where they have effects on function. And these are just some examples of what happens. On the left-hand side, you see a mutation occurring that doesn't affect the function, that's the ADP-ATP. But on the right-hand side, you see the drug Gleevec or imatinib, and it does affect the drug. So the organism has kept its functionality but rejected the drug. So what we can now do is take the methods that I was telling you about in our company and go back to this model, and we can work out a drug which will combat or be complementary, if you like, to the mutation that occurs in the tumour. So it's a battle, you see. You find a drug, the organism, whether it's a tumour or Mycobacterium tuberculosis, fights back and rejects it. You can then go back and redesign a drug. But, of course, The problems here are going to be huge because the expenses are very great, but in principle we can do it. And so the second generation drugs are already beginning to come for the very, very common mutations, and that's an area where we'll be working. Just very quickly then, the same sort of thing is happening with TB. So as I said, Bill Gates sent his man, Bill Duncan, to our company, asked us whether we would work on TB and not just oncology cancer. And we, as I said, decided to defocus the company. We moved it back into academia. Bill gave us some money, quite a lot of money, and we've been designing drugs against TB as well. And Bill Gates turned up in my lab. I once heard a commentator on the Today program say that if you get 30 seconds with Bill Gates, then you're very lucky as a journalist. We had him for 2 or 3 hours in our lab, just an amazing discussion. But what, of course, is happening in TB is that the key first-line drugs, like isoniazid, you're getting resistance to them. I think we better just ignore this. It's quite a complex picture, but what I want to tell you is that we know about the architecture that I've been telling you about. We know how the drugs bind, and as we see the resistance emerging, we're beginning to think, can we design for the very common resistance mutations new drugs? And so that's how it's going. There's lots of mechanisms of resistance. I just don't have time to go, but we can certainly begin to make drugs where the mutations are directly in the binding site of the drug. And so the mechanism, the conclusion I want to tell you is that with a fantastic group of people, and by the way, my lab's a bit lacking in English, but we can do 37 languages in the group. And we have everybody from mathematicians to medics. It's just a fantastic working environment and really exciting. And you can see why 4 years after I should have retired, I'm still getting up at 4 o'clock and working in the lab early in the mornings. But I hope what I've been able to tell you is that evolution is real. Don't let anybody tell you it isn't. You can see it. It moves fast. We've got to understand it in many cases. It tells you about all sorts of useful things about the cell by understanding it. But in particular, if we can understand the fast evolution of both pathogens and tumours, we can begin to get a much more sensible approach to making new drugs. So I just wonder when one of these creationists is given a drug for a mutated protein, eventually when we get one, I hope whoever administers it will tell them that it was designed because evolution is real. And so I leave you with those thoughts, and thank you very much for being patient.
Thank you very much, Sir Tom. That was a roller coaster. I'm sure Darwin would have absolutely loved it. Do we have questions? Can we have the lights up so a little bit more so we can see?
Not too difficult ones at this late stage of night.
Hi, thank you very much for a fantastic talk. Really enjoyed it. You said earlier in your talk that each cell within a tumour may be individual and have many mutations. In a Darwinian sense, we might expect that single clones or single cells become more successful and the heterogeneity to decrease as the disease progresses.
Yep.
Is this something that we see in cancer especially? Do we see a decrease in heterogeneity as it progresses? And how does that, how do the different metastases relate to each other in terms of that complexity?
I really don't think we have enough data yet. They're accumulating at a huge rate in the cosmic database, and we need to relate them in the way that you imply to different stages in the tumour, and that's going to be a major focus, both in the Institute of Cancer Research and the Sanger labs in Hinxton, and in the major centres like MD Anderson and Dana-Farber and Sloan Kettering in the US. I would think your hypothesis is right, and it would, if there's anybody young here, it would be a good project to look at. There's a question behind you, I think.
With the common tumours, such as lung cancer or colon cancer, does each tumour start with a single mutation in a single cell? And if so, is it environmentally caused?
So I didn't catch the first part, but almost all tumours will be caused by multiple factors. And so you may have some underlying personal changes in your DNA, and then you probably get other mutations accumulating. But it will be benign until you get to this later stage of evolution of it.
But are the initial mutations caused by something in the environment?
Yeah. Well, certainly some of them will be, but some of them may be just mistakes in the system anyway. And as I say, they'll probably be overlaying particular differences. They're called NSNPs. These are non-synonymous single nucleotide polymorphisms in the genes anyway. So it's going to be a complex interplay. I think it's very difficult at an early stage in a tumour to work out what's going to happen, as far as I can see from... But I mean, there are maybe other people in the audience have more experience in this. But it's an area where we're going to put a huge amount of effort internationally, I'm sure, because we need to get an early diagnosis. And the other thing is, even if we sequence every tumour, I'm not sure we're not going to have to sequence individual cells in the tumour, and it's going to be quite difficult to work out how to go from there. So I think there are many challenges, but it's a very, very, I think, exciting and optimistic scene at the moment.
Thank you. I wondered about a phrase you used, which has always given me a little bit of concern in relation to evolution.
Can you just put the microphone a little bit closer, because I can't...
Okay. I wondered about a phrase you used, because it appeared to imply an intrinsic intent by the cell undergoing evolution.
No,
you referred... I finish my sentence?
I didn't mean to.
You referred to HIV making mutations all over the place to get away from the drug.
Yeah. That's strictly wrong in every way. It's difficult not to say it, but it's not how it occurs. And you're right to pick me up on it.
I'm not a scientist, so this is probably a very simplistic question. It's often struck me, for example, I believe they've got cancer cells from a woman who died about 40, 50 years ago. She's gone, but the cells are still alive. They're kept in an American laboratory. I remember seeing it on a TV program. Mm. So the question that comes to my mind is, not that we all necessarily want to live forever, but of course those cells apparently have got the ability to live forever, even though the woman who had the cells is now long dead.
Yes.
The question I want to ask is it also possible to use your architectural approach to look at the positive aspects of these mutagens and pathogens and to derive from those potential benefits that could be applied to us so that we, in a beneficial way, begin to reflect those qualities in those individual areas of life, if you like.
I think it's one of the most difficult challenges, really working out how to extend life and have healthy aging. I think we're way away from it. I mean, the HeLa cells you're talking about, presumably, have been immortalized. Their life is not very interesting. My wife works on them. My main tease of her is as she rushes into the lab in the middle of the night, I say, "Don't worry, Lynn, your cells are immortal." But they're not. Of course, we're learning a lot about what makes life longer, but we're a long way away from it at the moment. The problems I'm describing here about a single mutation or two affecting a drug are hugely more simple than the kinds of problems that you're posing for us.
Well, thank you very much, sir, for that very erudite talk. Could I just ask you a related question, which is, you showed your slide about your travel all over the world, particularly in the East, and as we know, the three biggest killers in the East are HIV, malaria, and TB. And you've been working on TB and on mycobacterium and on malaria. Are we any closer to developing any vaccines against these three big killers?
I think, vaccines with HIV have been particularly difficult, and there's been a huge investment. TB, I think, is probably a better candidate for further work in that area. I must say, my vaccines are not my area of work, it's clear that for many areas they will provide a very good way forward. I think in the long run, we're going to need the classical type of small molecule drugs, but we have to look at both areas.
Hello. Thank you very much for a very interesting lecture. My question is a lay one, really, but there seems to be quite a link with hormones and the development of certain cancers, and I wonder what your views might be on either using hormones as a treatment or also as a potential vaccine for some of these cancers.
Yes, so it's true that many hormones and growth factors, I mean, insulin is both, for example, a hormone and a growth factor, really, they lead to growth of the cell, and they do it through various proteins which are related to oncogenes in many cases. So there's obviously a close relationship between growth factors and many of the pathways. I'm not sure you're going to solve the problem by stopping the growth factors in most cases, although in sometimes you may be able to regulate the cells. But quite often the pathways are taken over. So, for example, in the MET case that I talked about, which leads to metastasis, what you tend to get, and in many other growth factors, you get rearrangements that lead to overexpression or out-of-control expression. And I think they then go beyond the possibility of regulating them with a hormone. But I'm sure in many cases it would be worth looking at. But we need to know much more about which are the drivers in each tumour.
Can I ask one while we're getting the microphone?
Yeah.
An ordinary Darwinian adaptation at the organism level has perhaps even millions of generations to build itself up. Am I right in thinking that as cancer cells get better at being cancer cells, they, as it were, have to go back to scratch at the beginning of each tumour, so that there's only the time spent from the beginning of a tumour until the death of the patient in which the evolution can happen. So although it's getting better at being a cancer, it never gets to the sort of level of an eye or an ear or something like that, which has millions of generations to evolve.
I think that's right. And, of course, what tumours do is they abandon much of the complexity of the cell's regulation the cells that lead to the tumour. But I think you do have a sort of classical evolutionary situation of one or two cells mutating and then being able to form clones. So you have multiplication very quickly. So you can establish a tumour much more quickly than you can an organism in.
Because the generation time is so short
and it's much less complex an environment, I guess.
Hello. So I'm afraid my question is a rather trivial one, but I was wondering what drove you to be a scientist, and what would you say to young scientists?
I couldn't follow that. Did you get it, Richard?
Sorry. I was wondering what drove you to become a scientist, and what would you tell a young scientist?
What I should tell you if you want to be a scientist, going home, I drifted in. I'm not a typical scientist because I understand from my Science Council work that most students make up their mind between the ages of 11 and 14. I was still optimistic that I was going to be either an artist or a musician till I was about 17 or 18. So I think it's pretty hard and it's not terribly well paid. That's the problem. So you've got to enjoy it. But what is fascinating about it, and I hope you got this flavour, is you've certainly got beauty in the sort of work that I do in any kind of science, I think. You've got intellectual challenges, you've got excitement. I think one of the frustrating things is it's often very difficult to communicate it to others, and you can see what a problem I've had this evening.
You go ahead. Yeah, sorry, thank you. In regards to cancer treatment, your research is looking towards treating the protein produced by mutated DNA. Does this mean that these are lifelong treatments? These are treatments that people will have to take for the rest of their life? Or are you also looking at sort of actually fixing the DNA so that you can actually produce a cure to cancer?
Yeah. I mean, all of the drugs that we're developing are really just restraining the cancer. They're not changing the DNA. And that's the real challenge at the moment, because most drugs for cancer will extend your life by months or years, but they're certainly not a cure. But what you have to realise is that in a tumour, you've got 20,000-plus genes and many more gene products. And you're just making one or two very tiny mutations. And the problem of targeting the tumour without hitting the rest of your body is a real challenge. So most of the drugs are depending on the fact that the tumour is undergoing division and growing faster than the rest of the cells. So we're way away from any sort of DNA therapy, I think.
So my question was a bit related to this. Since those diseases are very fast at mutating and very good at mutating and evolving very fast, wouldn't it be more efficient to actually devise drugs that would prevent them from mutating and replicating so fast instead of trying to win the race against those mutations?
Gosh, I'm finding it very difficult to follow. If you just keep the microphone close to your mouth.
Wouldn't it be more efficient to devise drugs that would stop those diseases from replicating very fast and mutating very fast instead of trying to win the race against those mutations?
Yeah, well, it's quite difficult to stop. I mean, in the case of HIV, as I said, the whole system is much more sloppy, so you're constantly making errors. Of course, one of the other problems is that you have a very complex DNA repair system. Some of the things that tend to happen in tumours is the repair system becomes dysfunctional, and then you have even faster accumulation of changes. So it's quite a complex business. It's a sloppiness quite often. It's mutations that occur. It's lack of repair and so on. I think what you're saying, no doubt somebody will do, but I think it's, again, challenging. I'm sorry to be so negative, but this is just an amazingly difficult area.
So this oncogene that forms in this sort of cells, does that occur naturally anywhere in the body? And the scatter effect, has that got any natural benefits?
Yeah. So most of these oncogenes are there as natural genes. They're just ones that, if the tumour mutates, lead to a particularly large effect on growth or cell division. But some of them are natural genes where there's been a rearrangement. So the target of the Gleevec imatinib one is a translocation that brings one gene together with the other, and then it's of course turned on. So the bit that regulates it is removed effectively. So they're quite often natural genes which have been upregulated or the regulation has been removed. And that's why it's so difficult to target them, because you know very similar molecules are going to be in every cell of your body.
I think we've had a magnificent illustration of just how incredibly exciting modern science can be, and I'd like to thank Sir Tom very much for this splendid exhibition. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for listening to this special podcast brought to you by The Pod Delusion. The Pod Delusion is a weekly news magazine programme about interesting things. Listen to our weekly podcast at poddelusion.co.uk. But for now, thanks for listening.